is the Holy Spirit. This was a Trinity I could live with. One recommendation on which, surprisingly, both my mentors agreed was the discalced Carmelite nun Saint Teresa, Thérèse of Lisieux, also called the Little Flower. The Carmelites were the extremely strict order of enclosed nuns founded in 1562 by Saint Teresa of Avila, whom Father Joe therefore called the Big Flower. Thérèse of Lisieux died in 1897, when she was only 24, after a harrowing round of physical and spiritual travails. Respectful though Catholic kids were taught to be about the saints, especially modern ones, with their relevant messages for our sinful young lives, the Little Flower was a figure of fun, because her following, while enormous, tended to be female, long in the tooth, and gag-me sentimental. Her statue was always the soppiest in the church, goody-goody eyes rolled up to heaven, chipped plaster roses held to chaste bosom. I'd always dismissed her and her wildly popular autobiography, Histoire d'une âme, The Story of a Soul, as the worst kind of Victorian nun slush. There was a lot of three-hanky Victorian piety in The Story of a Soul, but to my surprise, I also found a very tough-spirited young woman. I found her single-mindedness about entering Carmel inspiringly familiar. Even more familiar, the curtain of darkness she endured, and the manifold doubts which constantly plagued her. I was now in my first year of sixth form, the rough equivalent of American high school, a committed artist rather than a scientist, as the Labour Party would probably have preferred. The armies of doubt, which had attacked so suddenly and savagely a few months earlier, had retreated, but not disarmed. The more I read and absorbed of my faith, of its defenders and expounders, the more there was to doubt. Every time they did attack, I would find they'd become more sophisticated, like bacilli that develop immunity to your body's defenses and return 10 times more dangerous. A useful distraction was English Lit, into which I plunged headfirst. Not just the curricula Spencer and Milton and Dryden and 19th-century novels, but Pound and Graves and Eliot, and therefore the metaphysicals, Orwell and other 20th-century novelists, like Forster and Conrad and Wolfe and War. The only problem was how much I liked it, and liking it brought an instant reflex that one day soon, if not tomorrow, I would have to try my hand at it. But, an enormous but for a proto-monk, the literature I was devouring, whether it was Shakespeare or Conrad or Pound or Orwell, dealt overwhelmingly with the world and its evil and sin, and furthermore, seemed to get more powerful and memorable the more evil and sinful the subject matter. Macbeth, The Heart of Darkness, Donne's violent, searing love poems, the list was endless. Obviously, this was no problem for students and or aspiring artists, who were happy to live in the world and wallow in evil and sin, which gave them all kinds of juicy raw material to be artistic about. But here's my problem, Father Joe. If art describes the way things are in the world, not the way things should be, and the more memorably the better, isn't that, well, celebrating evil and sin? Doesn't someone like me, who's getting ready to leave the world and its imperfection behind, sin by enjoying it? Good heavens, no, dear. At least I don't think so. Can you give me an example? Well, how about Macbeth? Tomorrow and tomorrow and tomorrow creeps in this petty pace from day to day, to the last syllable of recorded time. And all our yesterdays have lighted fools the way to dusty death. Out, out, brief candle. Life's but a walking shadow, a poor player that struts and frets his hour upon the stage, and then is heard no more. It is a tale told by an idiot, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. That's said by a murderer who sees no salvation or meaning in life. So why do I, who know there is salvation and meaning in life, love it so much? Why would murder and despair inspire great poetry? I know so little of art and literature, dear, but I'm sure the beauty of great art is intended by God. And nothing and no one in the world is so utterly evil as to be unredeemable. Imperfection is not irredeemably evil. Nor is it good, true, but making beauty out of imperfection seems to me very good. All right, can you give me an example? Well, I don't see how an artist who depicts the horror of the crucifixion and suffering of our Lord and makes it terribly and wonderfully real to us is sinning.
What if he loves wallowing in all that blood and gore? What if he enjoys painting the nails being driven through Christ's hands?
I don't really know, dear, not being an artist. But I wonder, is the artist enjoying Christ's suffering? Or is he enjoying rendering Christ's suffering so well? It must be very hard to separate one's feelings in the act of creation. And if creating beauty out of imperfection is good, it follows that the ability to create beauty is too.
All right. How about this? According to my art teacher, the reason so many Madonnas of the Renaissance painters, say, or the Dutch masters, are so beautiful is that the model, more often than not, was the artist's mistress. Isn't it sacrilege to portray the Blessed Virgin Mother of God as someone you're committing adultery with?
I can't imagine why, dear. We have no way of knowing if Our Lady was physically beautiful, of course, but we do know that she was spiritually beautiful. That's hard to show in a painting, isn't it? Making her physically beautiful could be a symbolic way of showing her spiritual beauty.
Well, what if the artist doesn't believe in God, or the Virgin, or even the idea of spiritual beauty?
I wonder whether that matters. If the result is beautiful, God is still the picture, the poem, and the song.
So is art somehow redemptive?
It might be, dear, yes. What an interesting thought.
The beauty created in the process of describing the world as it is, rather than the way it ought to be, compensates for the evil and sin which are being described.
That's rather a harsh way of defining art, don't you think, dear? Artists are creators. The beauty they create did not exist until they rendered it. In a way, that's godlike, isn't it? In that sense, art is an imitation of God.
Wait, are you saying that God, the creator, sees artists as fellow creators?
I don't see why not, dear. Though it might be best not to repeat that to Father Prior.
Or the abbot.
Never tell the abbot.
I still don't get it. If God has already redeemed the world, what's the point of art doing it as well? Does God need art? Does God like art? Does art like God? Where does God fit into the artist's version of the world? Is art a rebuke to God? An escape from God? A substitute for God? Why are so many artists atheists or agnostics? Father Joe said nothing for a moment. A little smile I'd never seen before played around his lips. It was mischievous and fond, and, unusual for him, a bit private, as if he were contemplating something he couldn't share.
Tony, dear Tony, I'm not nearly clever enough to answer these questions, but I think someday you will find the answers for yourself.
Here's what really worries me. Could it be that the more saintly you become, the less you need art? And conversely, that the less saintly you are, the better an artist you can be? That would mean that to write a great novel, I'll have to get to know some really wicked people. If I want to write a decent sonnet, I'll have to have sex with someone. Again, the mysterious smile. Why are you smiling like that, Father Joe? You look like the Mona Lisa.
I just enjoy being with you, Tony dear.
I didn't find Catholic writers, other than Green, much help in these concerns. Take Evelyn Waugh. I'd read Vile Bodies and The Loved One, which were cruel and hilarious. Not much Christian charity going on there. And the less there was, the funnier. Ditto Alexander Pope, at his best when nastiest. Eliot I worshipped. But my favourite poems, Prufrock, The Wasteland, were devastating, compassion-free commentaries on desperate humanity, who presumably would not have been desperate if they'd found God, which a good Christian like Eliot must have known. So shouldn't he have led them in that direction instead of calling them straw men who end with a whimper? On the other hand, I'd tried to read Murder in the Cathedral, a worthy stab at a wholly religious theme, and had fallen asleep. Conversely, as far as I could tell from my core-mandated reading, it seemed that the holier the writer, the worse the writing. Prove the rule's exceptions, like St. Augustine or St. John of the Cross, simply underlined the rarity of holy, unworldly writing worthy of the name art. The Jesuit Gerard Manley Hopkins could be accepted. While I responded to his ecstatics, I sensed something else going on beneath his verbal fireworks that was not the ecstasy of the saved. This was another tortured soul, like Green. An even more puzzling thing, almost all the Catholic writers I'd read and loved so far were converts. Weird that Green became a Catholic, then set out to disobey our rules, or wrote characters who did, wallowing in all kinds of highly artistic agonies. The convert thing went all the way back to Cardinal Newman and Hopkins. It even included the American poet and fellow follower of St. Benedict, Thomas Merton. Why were the converts setting the Catholic artistic agenda? Was it just my anti-Protestant prejudice? Or could it be that Catholic angst wasn't acceptable in England unless it came in an ex-Protestant package? Not that I had anything against converts. I was even trying to make a few. My first target was Michael Church. Mild-mannered and not at all argumentative, he looked like a pushover. I was rather surprised to find that high church folks believed in pretty much everything we Catholics did. The Trinity, the Incarnation, transubstantiation. The only problem, as I never tired of pointing out, was they couldn't do the big magic, since they weren't real priests. At the Reformation, they'd cut themselves off from the apostolic succession, the laying on of hands from bishop to bishop down all the centuries since the apostles, which made Catholic priests the real McCoy. Michael would always go rather pink at this line of argument, which I insensitively didn't realize was because I was saying his dad wasn't a real priest. I could usually bully him into agreeing that the Church of England had indeed broken the line of apostolic succession with Henry VIII, but I could never steer him past the big rocks. Devotion to Mary, which he insisted on calling Mariolatry, and the infallibility of the Pope, which I secretly sympathized with, since the Pope in question was the highly fallible 12th Pius. Even when Pius died a few months later, it didn't help. The new guy, a jolly old dear called John XXIII, looked like fallibility incarnate. Conversion of the godless Protestants was just one aspect of a generally reformist zeal I was feeling that year. The most dramatic expression of it was directed at the core, the British equivalent of ROTC. Corps had to parade or muster, or whatever idiotic militarese was used, once a week. Boys from 12 up were required to wear full British infantry khakis, including blister-inducing black boots, webbing around the ankles, and a web belt. The toe caps of the boots had to be spit and polish, so that the older boys, the NCOs, could see their pimply faces in them. Belts and ankle webbing had to be blancoed, daubed to a dazzling white, with a revolting eponymous paste called Blanco. This process alone took hours. I often stayed up past midnight using several tins of boot polish as I tried to figure out just the right ratio of polish to spit so that the NCO morons could admire their Elvis pompadours in my boot caps. There was something wrong with my spit, and I never could buff to the requisite shine, which led to automatic penalties. On Corps Day, We were given heavy old World War I rifles and taught to drill. Up and down the playground, in squads, in step, turning right and left, swiveling our eyes, stopping, lining up, standing at attention, sloping arms, presenting arms, and marching along the roads surrounding the school to destinations in the far-off countryside, sweating in the summer, freezing in the winter. There we were given lessons in map reading and identifying topographical features. Bushy-topped tree has stayed with me for some reason, and every now and then getting lessons in the use of the fixed bayonet and other delicate arts of expressing displeasure with your opponent, none of which had been used in warfare since the 19th century, and would not have been of the slightest use when we actually became cannon fodder in the initial exchange twixt Yank and Ruskie. But that's to grace the process with too much meaning. There was no purpose to any of it, except to instill in us habits of craven obedience to the most cretinous boys in the school. As in any military community, the most violent and pin-headed members of the tribe, those who obeyed orders without question and had the lungs to prove it, those with shinable spit, rose swiftly to positions of command. As one who'd pledged his obedience elsewhere, I couldn't be part of this. There wasn't much an ink-stained schoolboy could do to stop the air-conditioned killers in the Pentagon or the sweaty gangsters in the Kremlin, but I could certainly try to stop war in my own playground. Before I could take any steps, however, Corps had to give its blessing. War was a hot topic in the Faith and Morals Department, and I wanted to be certain I wasn't on thin, doctrinal ice. My confessor surprised me with the familiar arguments for a just war. "But, Father Joe, the argument for a just war can't hold in a nuclear age, can it? Nuclear weapons are designed to murder untold millions of non-combatants, which is specifically forbidden in a just war." I hadn't quite finished, dear. "In practice, I'm not sure there ever has been a just war. Look at the Albigensian Crusade. Even in the last war, the Allies committed terrible crimes against the innocent. Hiroshima, for example." I'd just devoured William Golding's masterpiece, Lord of the Flies, and had been enraptured by its savage metaphor. For me, his schoolboy castaways and their grim evolution represented in microcosm how things all too easily went in the larger tribe of the nation. So, too, the Corps, with its absurd dynamic, was a microcosm of the British military, if not all militaries. "Father Joe, I believe that war is not just some neutral thing that happens, like the weather. War is sin committed by certain people. A certain kind of person will always try to find ways around the Fifth Commandment because of their terrible need to kill. These men are called soldiers. They exist in any tribe, nation, empire, or superpower, and wherever they're found, they're the same murderous parasites. People whose lives can only be fulfilled by crushing the life out of another. They call themselves heroes, but they're actually diabolical lunatics who arrogate to themselves the power that belongs to God alone, the power to end life." You could be right, Tony dear, about military men and their motives, but you must remember, military men, too, are children of God, loved by God, candidates for salvation. Even mass murderers, if they want forgiveness and reach out for it, can be forgiven."
"They don't want forgiveness, Father Joe. They hate forgiveness. It prevents war. They're a brotherhood that cuts across all beliefs, all causes, all interests, all politics, all patriotisms. Their greatest enemy is not, as they argue, another nation's military, for it's another nation's military that gives them their raison d'être. Their true enemy is us, people of peace, like this boy called Piggy in The Lord of the Flies, who resists death and embraces life, who doesn't want to murder or to die, and whom the soldiers of the tribe, therefore, murder." Father Joe was silent now, watching me curiously, as if he was seeing some aspect of my character he hadn't quite grasped before. I found this emboldening. I went into the more or less rehearsed part of my presentation, the part I hoped would close the deal. "If we could get rid of the military
theirs and ours, we'd take a giant step toward ridding the world of war for good. That goes for all quasi-military activities as well, like our Corps. In a way, the Corps is a metaphor just like Lord of the Flies. It shows in microcosm how the military works. It tries to reduce us to unthinking machines so that we can do something we have no right to do under any circumstances, take another life. If I refuse to participate in the Corps, I'm refusing to participate in the soldiers' need to murder others in some future war. Corps is just the continuation of war by other means. I was pretty pleased with this punchline, but it seemed to have little effect on Father Joe. He closed his twitching eyes and pursed his big lips in deep message-receiving mode. There was a long beat of silence. "Tony, dear, you sound angry. Very angry. Like a military man speaking with hate of his enemy. War involves terrible sins, and it arises more often than not from hate. But you can't conquer one sin with another. Hate with more hate. It only makes hate stronger. Love alone can conquer hate." He took my hand between his. The usual warmth flowed into me, and as I relaxed, I realized how pumped up I'd been, how cold and hard and alien I'd made myself to get my point across, how, in some way I could not discern, dishonest. "Oh, of course you must leave the Corps if you feel this way, but not in anger, in humility and with mercy. Remember, God's grief at the unspeakable things we do to one another is beyond measuring, but so is his mercy. It might seem a terrible thing to say to people who've lost and suffered so much at the hands of hatred and violence, but true courage is not to hate our enemy any more than to fight and kill him. To love him, to love in the teeth of his hate, that is real bravery. That ought to earn people medals.
The Corps was nominally commanded by various masters, who, for playing soldier each week, were given an officer's commission, from lieutenant all the way up to colonel. In reality, it was run by the iron fist of Sergeant Major Kilpatrick, a rust-faced old blowhard with a military moustache the same colour, so rotund he always seemed about to burst every insanely burnished brass button on his tunic. He'd been in the Scots Guards or something, and had a Scots accent you could cut with a claymore. When I told him I was quitting the Corps as a conscientious objector, I tried hard to love him.
"What's that stupid look on your stupid face, Hendra? You look like you're going to be sick."
I toyed with plunging into my Soldiers' Corps Wars speech, but decided it would not be wise.
"You can't be a CO. You're Catholic."
"Yes, sir, please, sir, but that doesn't mean I believe in war, sir."
"Who's talking about war, you ridiculous boy? You wouldn't know a war if it bit you in the bottom. The Corps is about discipline, building character."
Yes, sir, please, sir, but I don't think carrying guns and obeying idiots builds character, sir."
"Who are you calling an idiot, Hendra?"
I threw love to the winds and gabbled out a list of Corps morons with NCO rank, but the damage was done. He sent me to the headmaster, a formidable martinet named Marsh. Headmaster Marsh took the same tack. Catholics, except he used the word papists, couldn't be COs. Evidently, the authorities believed that the Church of Rome either A, didn't have enough conscience to object to war, or B, was an enthusiastic non-objector to war on the slightest of pretexts. But I stuck to my guns, and to my surprise, the school's military-civilian junta caved in. They drew the line at my next move, trying to persuade others to become refuseniks. Converting people to a different faith was one thing. Converting them from a belief in militarism, quite another, beyond the pale, a sacrilege. In any case, I was soon grappling with a far more pervasive and persuasive enemy, the nascent consumerist society, and in particular, the extremely confusing area of adolescent pleasures and possessions. Drinking and smoking, owning a motor scooter, buying cool clothes, had no moral pluses or minuses for most of my schoolmates. They were uniformly desirable, but not necessarily for monks in training. The 50s were racketing to an end. While Britain was still extremely broke, there were hints of a new system that would make you need stuff you didn't need, whether you could afford it or not. Apparently, it was all very exciting. Even more exciting, the youth economy was beginning to take off, in clothes, grooming, movies, music. Products in these areas tended to be imported from America, or, if domestic, to be conceived and sold on an American model. For the first time, a generational gap opened up, giving the new American-style marketers a clearly defined testing ground for their first shot at national manipulation of consumers. My friends and acquaintances were tremendously worked up, or were being tremendously worked up, about rock and roll, dancing, drinking, cars, motorbikes, sports, movies, television, clothes, and hairstyles, especially when these products were designed or tailored for youth. I took pleasure in many things: music, art, films, decent food and drink when I could wangle it. When it came to such consumer necessities as clothes, cars, hairstyles, and the rest, the teenage monk tended to kick in. But it was hard to avoid the novelty and force of the marketing that pushed them into your consciousness. And I would oscillate wildly between wistful yearning for just a taste of such temptations and rigid puritanical rejection of everything the late 50s had to offer. More significant was that I found myself fascinated by the process by which things were sold to people, by advertising and marketing, especially on television, which seemed both morally insidious and creatively brilliant. I asked Father Joe for guidance on the question of possessions. We started with St. Benedict's rule and the vows I would one day take.
Chapter 33, dear, if memory serves. No one may presume to retain anything as his own, nothing at all, not even a book, writing tablets, or a stylus. All things shall be the common possession of all.
Very well, Father. Right now, I'm ready to give up all my worldly goods. Sports jacket, one, handed down from Dad, who's too fat for it. Bike, one, peeling chrome and broken bell included. Flaminaire cigarette lighter, one, designed to impress contemporaries at the Albert Hall during promenade concerts. But I have to say, this sounds a lot like communism.
St. Benedict doesn't want your cigarette lighter, dear. And he's not a communist. At least I don't think so. Though now you mention it, he does sound a bit like one, doesn't he? St. Benedict is saying that owning things, something the world takes for granted, in fact insists is a right, has important spiritual consequences. Possessions are extensions of the self, you see. They become the walls of that prison of self you once talked about. The more possessions, the less likely will be your release from the prison. In our community, property is forbidden because it gets in the way of love and trust between its members. If every man had his own private property, the community would just be a collection of individual prisons, wouldn't it?
I found this far more persuasive than the puritanical approach, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. Father Joe's analysis of the nature of ownership was much shrewder. The marketer's true target, after all, is the self. Self is the beginning and end of selling. This product will extend yourself out into an impressionable world. The more of these fine products you have, the more formidable yourself. And of course, the more barriers you have set up to clear and open contact with the other. Shop till you drop, and true love may well be mutually exclusive. Father Joe stressed that his analysis didn't mean owning things was wrong, any more than that the pleasures you derived from them were wrong, which went back to the old principle. Contemptus mundi was not contempt for the world, but detachment from it.
It all depends how you see your possessions, dear, and the pleasures they give. You must be able to give them up without a moment's regret.
The obligation of detachment led me to a deeper understanding of the pleasures offered by possessions. It seemed clear that however varied were the pleasures to be had from them, the pleasures all had in common that they were fleeting and finite. Pursuing them serially looked like a guarantee of regret and disappointment. It was the nature of pleasure to bloom, wither, and die. Pleasure was the slave of time. I didn't have to be a sage old libertine to know that. Pleasure could be sublime. Some pleasure might even be momentary contact with the divine. But it had an inevitable downward curve. I saw my life as a very different graph, a constantly rising growth curve with no upper limit, self-discipline leading to self-reduction and thence to self-loss. My ultimate goal was zero. The greater my loss, the more I would profit. I was going in exactly the opposite direction from my contemporaries, the crowd streaming by me on either side, as I fought my way back to something simpler and older, and, I believed, truer. It included poverty and community, perhaps even a pre-feudal form of socialism. I was skeptical of the value of the pleasures offered by a technological society. I believed commercial gratification of my appetites was an impediment to a full and happy life. I had no interest in extending myself through possessions of any kind. It was a good thing I was going to be a monk. As a unit in the coming consumer utopia, I was absolutely useless. Chapter 10. Then there was sex. Or rather, then there wasn't. But sex was one pleasure dome in which my absence may have gone unnoticed. Most of my schoolmates didn't get any either. We were pre-pill, and rubbers were unobtainable unless you could prove you were 21, or your dad owned a pharmacy. On the other hand, you could buy a pack of cigarettes as soon as you were 16 and drink yourself senseless, too. The new Elizabethan era had its priorities straight. Sexually, I'd probably gone as far as any guy I knew, and I'd done it 3 years earlier. I did have one friend, a scrofulous, soi-disant French existentialist, who claimed to have a mistress, but he showed a less than Camus-like interest in the dirty bits of 1984, and I was dubious. Sex is the elephant in any teenage monk's living room. To tell the truth, though, it wasn't that hard to flee fornication. The Freudian physics of repression appeared quite erroneous. Once I got into the mental habit of abstinence, sex popped up in the teeming jungle of my brain far less often than in the old pre-monastic days when I'd enjoyed 60 or 70 self-induced orgasms a day. There was the odd dreamland whoops, known in church parlance by the hideous euphemism nocturnal emission, but Father Joe soon set me straight on the rap for that, which was zero. However, there was sublimation, which always landed me in a briar patch of guilt and scruples. In the fall of my second sixth-form year, we began studying Michelangelo. It was the first time I had ever paid much attention to sculpture. I was hypnotized by the beauty of his statues. They had the same inevitability as Beethoven's music or Shakespeare's tragedies. The final statement on this figure in that space never to be surpassed, ordained long before Michelangelo existed, waiting for him to be born and to chisel them just that way. One of his lesser-known statues really got to me, the Madonna of Bruges. This Madonna is a very young woman, not much more than a teenager, her eyes cast down as the angel annunciates her destiny. I had only a few photos to go on, but I fell utterly in love with the Madonna of Bruges. I couldn't get enough of that exquisite face, that perfect profile, that delicious, eyes-cast-down modesty. I dreamed of her all the time. I couldn't get her out of my mind. All this was platonic. I never fantasized anything sexual about her, not even what might lie under her heavy Madonna gear. But she might as well have been alive, for all the stellar qualities my love invested in her. It broke my heart that I would never meet her, never talk to her, never see that gorgeous face move, those soft lips part, those eyes rise and turn toward me. Even if I went to Bruges, even if I spent the rest of my life adoring her, my love would always be locked away in stone. Unfortunately, the photos in question were in a large art book in the art room, and we had art only once a week. This was long before photocopying, so I had to sneak up there on all kinds of pretexts to catch a glimpse of my beloved. The art master, a fat, bald, pseudo-Falstaffian character called Tanner, who looked and dressed as if he might once have painted chunky, heroic, social realist proletarians, but now preferred whining about the Tories down at the pub, grew suspicious of these visits. Embarrassed by my obsession, I made up some story about including Michelangelo in an essay I was doing on the Renaissance. But the David was on the cover, and the book had a way of falling open at the David section, which, of course, included many loving close-ups of David's splendid pecs and abs and thighs and buttocks. Tanner became quite convinced that it was Dave I fancied, and forever after gave me a wide berth in class, shooting me the kind of disgusted grimaces only red-blooded working-class social realists are capable of. Not long afterward, I gave him cause. Almost. For the first and last time in my life, I fell for a boy. He was in the fifth form, two grades behind me. So I'd been familiar with his sour little mug for years, without having the slightest interest in him. He was a small, standoffish, rather taciturn kid who never smiled. Suddenly, one day, he struck me as having become, at some point when I wasn't looking, extraordinarily beautiful. Years later, I came across a school photo of him at the time, and he was indeed extraordinarily beautiful. Again, this obsession had nothing overtly sexual about it. I didn't fantasize about him. I didn't even dream about him. I had no urge to touch him, or hold him, or see him without his clothes on. Quite the contrary. At one point, he made it onto the school field and track team, which I was also on. I got an eyeful of his scrawny legs and mad running style, frenetic and short-paced, like a chicken on speed, which was almost the end of it, right there. But as with the Madonna, I couldn't take my eyes off that face. The perfectly straight nose and chiseled nostrils, the long almond eyes and dark lashes, the hair curling forward on the forehead, the round chin above the graceful throat, the full, solemn lips of the unsmiling, sculpted mouth. I was a prefect by now, so it would have been very easy to force myself into his company, whether he liked it or not. But I was uncomfortable about being a prefect. I suspected the junta was just trying to co-opt me, so that there would be no more sabotage. I hated wielding authority, just as much as I'd hated being on its receiving end. So I just gazed on his beauty from afar. My examinations of conscience revealed nothing in these alarming experiences which I could pinpoint as major sin. There was a whiff of blasphemy about being in love with a Madonna, except that it wasn't the actual factual virgin. As for the object of my pristine desire, I was completely at sea. I was sex-ed free, bred to accept legendary platonic relationships, both in the classical and British imperial periods. Homophilia was not even on my radar. I wondered if both obsessions sprang from some rarefied version of idolatry, but that was as close as I could get to a Class A no-no. Still, these feelings must be major imperfections, couldn't be normal, not for a monk in training and future saint. The school workload was getting heavy, and it was a while before I could check in with Command Central. But at least there was nothing sexual about them.
Of course they're sexual, dear. What's wrong with that?
What about chastity?
Chastity doesn't involve surgery, does it? We're still sexual beings. Sex is a wonderful gift, a physical way to express the most powerful force in all existence, love. Sex is a brilliant idea of God's, I think, almost like a sacrament.
Sex is a sacrament?
Don't tell the abbot.
There's no sin in having sex?
Yes. There can be. But sex is a sin less often than we're led to believe. It's all a question of context. If you have sex to hurt or exploit another, or to take pleasure only for me, and not return as much or more to your lover, then it becomes sinful. We monks make promises before God and the community to remain celibate. For us to have sex would be a betrayal of God and our brothers. It's not the sex, so much as breaking the vow, that is the sin. Just as it is when you break a vow of marriage, the hurt to your partner. They've made sexual sins the worst sins of the lot, haven't they? Because sex is so powerful, people are fearful of it. We must take the fear out of sex as well.
In 1958, with Vatican II just a twinkle in Pope John's eye, a time when the Church's rules, laws, mysteries, sanctions surrounding sex were still harsh and reflexive, such views were remarkable. I was always somewhat baffled that this monk, who had never slept with man or woman, who had confined himself in a cloister in late puberty, could know and feel so much about a matter he'd taken a strong vow to know not. At least in the sense that the modern world means to know, which is to have laboratory evidence, hands-on experience of your subject. He had none of that, yet he got it all. Nothing shocked or surprised him. He always grasped immediately the core of a sexual crisis. He always offered practical solutions. It was a mystery. He completely turned around the old precept of practice what you preach. He preached, brilliantly, what he could never have practiced. That same afternoon, we revisited the topic in a rather roundabout way. I had read Eliot's critical essays, through which I'd discovered Dante, and was now teaching myself the rudiments of Italian, to get a handle on that glorious terza rima. In turn, I was giving Father Joe a taste of L'Inferno. We were kicking through the autumn leaves in the oak woods. He loved the sound of Italian, though he spoke little at the time, and was repeating after me the few lines I knew. I'd got to Paolo and Francesca, the damned lovers, murdered in flagrante, where Francesca speaks to Dante, as Paolo weeps in the background. Amor che nulla matto amar perdona. Mi prese del costui piacer si forte, che, come vedi ancor, non m'abbandona. And Eliot's favorite. Nessun maggio dolore che ricordassi del tempo felice nella miseria. Eyes closed, lips working in his word-tasting mode, Father Joe repeated the lines in faultless Italian. Spoken like a 14th-century Tuscan, Father Joe.
Now, let me try and translate. Nessun, no greater sorrow than ricordassi, remembering?
Yes.
Remembering a happy time in misery? Very good, Father Joe.
Thank you, dear. It's the Latin, you see. Haunting, harrowing, almost as if he'd actually visited hell.
Should they have gone to hell for having sex?
For having sex in the 13th century? Probably.
What about now?
Probably not.
Isn't that a bit unfair?
Yes, but Dante is quite nice to them, really. Each still has the other, don't they? Piacer si forte, che come ved ancor non m'abbandona. A joy so strong, he still does not abandon me. There's still that bond, that love between them, you see. Something divine, even in hell. Interesting.
Human love is divine?
Oh, I think so, yes. I've often thought true love between two human beings is inspired by the Holy Spirit. Or even is the Holy Spirit. Though I'm not sure the abbot would agree. Human love can be just as saintly love. Not nearly enough husbands and wives have been canonized.
You should talk to the new Pope.
I will, dear, I will. I'll telephone him when we get back. Now, Tony, dear, before I forget, I didn't give you your penance this morning.
I'd gone to confession that morning about my recent sexual obsessions, and indeed he hadn't given me my penance, though his penances were generally mild. I figured I'd been clean enough to get off scot-free.
Your penance is, you must go out for the evening with a pretty girl.
What?
I'm training to be a monk. It can be part of your training, then. Don't be like us old fogies in here and give up what you never had.
Is this because I fell in love with a statue?
Go dancing or something.
Just go dancing?
And kiss her goodnight.
Must I really?
Obedience, dear. St. Benedict's first rule.
I didn't know any pretty girls. I didn't know any plain girls. I didn't know any girls, period. My mother had been trying various transparent ruses to derail the monastic vocation, like hiring nubile babysitters for the younger kids when she and Dad went out. Conversations with them were stilted. It didn't take a three-figure IQ to question why my parents needed a babysitter with a hulking 17-year-old in the house. Was it me they were babysitting? I did have a bevy of female cousins not far away, one of whom was my age and undeniably cute. Teen functions involving this brood came up quite often. I was routinely invited, and I routinely refused. When the next one arrived, as per monastic instructions, I accepted. Mum went into overdrive, actually spent money making me look fetching, got Dad to drive me. She was in a fever of excitement. Where I was concerned, morganatic marriage was no problem. As they got ready in their bedroom, I heard her hiss to Dad, "It's a foot in the door!" At the dance, her sister, my cousin's mother, hissed to her, "It's a foot in the door!" My mother's other sisters hissed at one another on the phone next day, "It's a foot in the door!" My cute cousin had no more interest in getting hitched than I did. In fact, I told her I was her date, on specific orders from the monastic brass. Being a good Catholic girl, she found this hilarious. "First time I've ever been someone's penance." She plied me with questions about the monastery, and we had a few drinks. She taught me to rock and roll, first to Bill Haley, then to a song whose chorus went, "It's late, we gotta get on home, it's late, we gotta get on home, it's late, we gotta get on home." A perfect out, we agreed. That was that. Penance completed. In the fall of 1958, I began my second year in the sixth form, Americans 12th grade, and my final year in school. At the end of this school year, I would be turning 18. The academic pressure was considerable. The year culminated in A-levels, exams in your chosen subjects, which would determine whether and where you went to college. Most guys also took S, scholarship, levels, more advanced exams, which could win you a scholarship to a better grade of university. Preparing for both was grueling. Over and above this, for a handful of students, there were the Oxford-Cambridge entrance exams, the top of the line. I'd pledged to Dad that I'd finish my schooling. And I would, which I interpreted as taking the required exams, in my case, A and S levels. Then I would apply to Core, and I was confident, given my hard work, perseverance, and slow but steady spiritual progress, Father Joe would accept me. If at some point in the future the community decided I had to go to college, I wouldn't have to go, according to my understanding of Benedictine procedure, until I'd taken my final vows, at least 3 years later. In sixth form, I had acquired a ferociously strict English teacher named Mr. Heather. Mr. Heather had told me I was one of his best pupils, but in class and in marking papers, he bore down on me mercilessly. "For your own good," he'd say, brush moustache bristling over thin grey lips. Other, more knowing boys would splutter over the name Mr. Heather, Heather being a popular girl's name at the time, though never to his face. He was very buttoned up, scrupulous in dress, and ruthless in discipline. When he expounded his literary likes and dislikes, he was coldly but intensely passionate. Everything he said was shot through with melancholy, as if only a sense of duty was keeping him on the disastrous path he'd chosen at some earlier crossroads. Out of the blue, Mr. Heather suggested that I take the Oxford-Cambridge entrance exams that year. I resisted, since I wasn't the least interested in doing it just for practice. But because I couldn't tell him the real reason, that I had no intention of going to Oxford or Cambridge or any other university, and because he was hugely intimidating, I went along, figuring I had zero chance of winning a place anyway. One bright, cold November day, Dad drove me up the A1 to Cambridge in our latest lemon. He was ill at ease in Cambridge. To him, this was not just a place of public school and aristocratic privilege, but the stronghold of those upper-crust culture arbiters whose double snobbery he dealt with all the time. To my surprise, I found the old part of Cambridge friendly and familiar. Most of the original colleges were built either as monastic houses or on a monastic model. I stayed at Queen's College in a room, a cell, really, above a cloistered court, and felt quite at home sitting under the arches in my hooded coat, murmuring the offices of the day. The exams consisted, for the most part, of essay questions. The topics seemed vague to me, and easy to twist round to anything you wanted to write about. For 2 days I ripped off a few hundred words on each, feeling a great sense of apartness from the sweating, fearful cohorts of pan-British genius around me. Every one of them cared terribly about the outcome of the exam, the passport to a glorious future that it might give them. I didn't give a damn. Mr. Heather had advised me not to evidence religiosity in my essays, as it would be held against me by the markers. But I wasn't going to Cambridge anyway, so I threw caution to the winds. I arm-wrestled one question around to Dante's Inferno, and wrote an impassioned screed on why modern secular interpretations of the Divine Comedy, like Benedetto Croce's, which set aside Dante's medieval beliefs in favor of his poetry, totally misread the whole narrative thrust of the poem. Inferno, I argued, was driven by a clear and decidedly medieval message. The moral compromise its actors had made with the real world had been punished. You couldn't separate Dante's absolute belief in sin and hell, and, therefore, his grasp of the terrible predicament of its denizens, from either the passion of his poetry or the compassion he shows toward the damned. It went on for 20 pages of white-hot longhand. I returned to school and resumed preparations for the actual goal of the year, the A-levels. The Oxford-Cambridge exams were history,
Mr. Heather was appeased, and the Christmas holidays began. Relieved no end, I went to work at the post office to help with the Christmas rush. Our house wasn't on the route I covered, so I didn't see the letter. But I did see Dad, silhouetted in the light of our back door, as I trudged down our dark, slushy driveway a few nights before Christmas. He'd been there for ages, Mum said, standing out in the freezing cold, waiting for me to come down the lane, so he could be the first to tell me. The letter was small and square. Inside was a sheet of creamy white vellum embossed in black Gothic script. St. John's College, Cambridge. Dimly and unevenly typed on a very old typewriter was the information that I'd been awarded an exhibition at St. John's College to the value of £90 per annum. An exhibition was a lesser scholarship, not as illustrious as a full scholarship, but way above a mere place. For the first time I could remember, my dad took me in his arms and hugged me tight. He had his generation's dread of spontaneity and physical contact. He'd never done anything like this, even when I was a little boy. I wasn't used to being held against his tubby body, to smelling the day-old aftershave on his jowls. But how could I not respond? The man was trembling with joy, beside himself with it, incapable of speech. I hugged him back, and he seemed to become aware of our contact as something utterly unprecedented. He held me at arm's length. "So wonderful, Anthony! So wonderful! What a Christmas present!" It was a culmination for him of many things. His own choice to become an artist instead of something useful. His political faith in the correctness of socialism, a respite from the downturn of his career now that all the memorials had been painted and the war damage repaired. Wrapped up in the simple, giddy joy a parent has in a child's success. He said none of this, but it was radiating from every molecule in his body. It was probably one of the few truly happy moments of his life. And for me, an utter disaster. What was I to do now? No way I was taking up this scholarship. But I couldn't tell Dad that. It would break his heart. Still, telling Dad a white lie, or simply not telling him at all, call it a white deception, wasn't new. What was new was the realization, dawning over the next few days, that it might not be smart to tell Father Joe either. Probably it would be fine. Probably he'd just tell me to think it through carefully. Probably he'd accept that by the time I entered Corps next summer, I would be 18, with all my choices legally my own to make. Or would he? I was accustomed by now to being upended by his responses. There was an outside possibility that my spiritual dad might have a problem too, especially if he knew what it meant to my actual dad. I couldn't risk that. The thought of not being able to enter, after all this time, 3 interminable teenage years, after all this self-doubt and solitude, all the dark nights when I yearned to be at Corps and sink gently beneath the surface of the communal peace. No. I couldn't risk that. I couldn't risk even the slimmest possibility of that. Back at school, the landscape had changed. I was now a senior prefect, the school librarian, captain of swimming, and a veteran of the athletics team, among other minor honors like being in school plays. I was also, according to the stats, one of the more academically accomplished students of my year, and unique in one respect. The other brainiacs had few sports credits, and the other sportsoids had few academic ones. The previous head of school had won a university place and was leaving before the end of the year. Within weeks, there would be no head of school. I was a possible candidate. I said I wasn't interested, which I really wasn't. It was inexcusably worldly even to consider being the head goon. Mr. Heather had other ideas. I was his star pupil now,
his champion. He would become my academic trainer, toweling me down for the next scholastic bout. He lobbied Headmaster Marsh hard to make me the next head of school. Marsh didn't immediately make up his mind. He scheduled interviews with several candidates. I was first. According to Mr. Heather, the other meetings were mere formalities to avoid hurt feelings. In I went to Marsh's large and lavish office. He was a taut, four-square guy who'd served in the Navy in the war and was also a formidable classics scholar. Navy brusque and blunt and intimidatingly brilliant. A nasty combination. The interview went like this.
Come in, Hendra, come in. No need to sit down. This will only take a moment. I'm well aware, and I'm sure you realize, that you're the best candidate to be next head of school. You're an excellent all-rounder, and that's what we always look for in a head boy. And I haven't failed to note that your refusal to participate in Corps did not lead to further unpleasantness. A sign of maturity, that, Hendra. However, I wouldn't dream of appointing you head boy. Why? You're a papist. We can't possibly have a papist as head of a Christian school. You couldn't attend services in the Abbey, which would set an appalling example to the other boys, and doubtless offend many parents. And of course the old boys would be outraged. So there we are. I'm sure you understand.
Absolutely, sir.
Good man, Hendra, and good luck to you.
Thank you, sir.
A fitting conclusion to my first 18 years. They now wound down to their destined end. The remaining months at school had to be served out. I spent them acquainting myself further with the Roman ruins down the road, swimming, cutting classes I didn't feel like attending, organizing the library on the Dewey Decimal System. I took the S-levels in a benevolent haze. They seemed like easier versions of the Cambridge exams. I even recycled the Dante rant. My scores were excellent. Mr. Heather was happy. Dad was happy, too. He'd filled out endless government forms in triplicate, something he usually cursed Blue Murder about, to obtain the state assistance for me to go to Cambridge. It had been approved and granted. In anticipation of the receipt thereof, a Westminster bank account was being opened for me at the Cambridge branch. Dad wouldn't have to pay more than a few pounds toward my tuition. It was somewhat conscience-easing that this wouldn't be assessed until after the end of my first year. Since there wasn't going to be a first year, he wouldn't have to pay a penny. School ended with no bangs or whimpers and few regrets. I turned 18 without fanfare. I put in a couple of weeks on a quiet family vacation. A bit later, I announced my intention of going off to the seaside for a while with a few friends. Like